Senhores deputados, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, I must first of all be grateful to Dr. Rajendra for the opportunity to come to the Committee of Environment and to participate a little bit in your intensive agenda, a little bit about the things and the analyzing the thing related to environment. Dr. Rajendra Pachauri was elected as chairman of Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this panel was established by World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations. We know what was the work of this panel in order to face the problems related to the situation of climate and mainly the change of climate. And I think that it was a very important work, and it is a very important work that has some kind of targets in the different conferences that take place all around the world. Last one was in Copenhagen. The next one is in Mexico, in Cancun, and of course, the main idea about that is in order to face these problems and at the same time to have the governments, the executives, the different institutions working in order to have a better world, of course, with a better climate. We know what is happening about this change climate, and we understand what is happening in different parts of the world. In my country, as we had the opportunity to talk a little bit with the Speaker of our Parliament, we had the opportunity to understand what is our worries about the evolution of some kind of desertification in the south of the country, similar to what is happening perhaps in the area of our neighbor, Spain, in the south also. And of course, this is a small part of all the problem. So I'm very glad and I'm very honored to present you to our members of this committee. And I'm honored also, as chairman of this committee, to have you in my parliament. And I thank you again for that opportunity to come here because I know that your agenda was very intensive, but you had a small part of your time related to the Portuguese Parliament. So thank you again. Everybody knows your career about the issues of environment, your participation in a lot of universities, and the main task, this is the evolution about the work of this panel on climate change. So thank you again. We are very glad and very honored to be with you here. And now, of course, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a great privilege to be here in this elegant building and in the precincts of the Parliament of Portugal and to talk to the members of your committee. I'm also very grateful that Her Excellency, the Ambassador of India, Mrs. Primrose Sharma, is here with us. Let me start by just giving you a brief background of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change because, as it happens, unfortunately, in recent months, there has been a lot of material carried in the media attacking the IPCC, and I feel it's appropriate for me to tell you about how the panel functions. The IPCC, as the chairman mentioned, was established in 1988 by the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations Environment Programme. And our work is to carry out an assessment of all aspects of climate change. And I must say we have had a great deal of good fortune to have enthused the entire scientific community all over the world to work for the IPCC without any payment for their services from the IPCC. So these are people who volunteer to work on a mission that basically deals with all aspects of climate change, the science of climate change. Just to give you an indication, during the fourth assessment report, which was completed in 2007, we had about 450 what we call lead authors. And these are the people who actually write the report. Then we had about 800 approximately contributing authors. These are authors who are specialized in some field or the other, and they provide inputs to those who are writing the reports. For instance, somebody may be a specialist on ocean acidification, which is taking place. So he'll prepare a detailed paper on ocean acidification and give it to these authors, and they can then use it in writing the report. We also carry out a review of every draft of the report, and this is done actually at four different stages. And at each stage, we have expert reviewers who carry out very meticulous editing and scrutiny of the report, and they will provide comments to the authors. In the fourth assessment report, we had something like 90,000 comments altogether, and each one of them has to be taken into account. If a comment is not accepted, then you have to record the reasons. The authors have to record the reasons why it was not accepted. And of course, if it is accepted, you just mention accepted. So I'm mentioning this only to say that this is an extremely transparent process. It's a process which is peer-reviewed at every stage. And an assessment report, like the fourth assessment report, consisted of something like 3,000 pages of material. So it is a fairly gigantic scientific undertaking. The strength of the IPCC also lies from the fact that all our reports are accepted by all the governments. We are an intergovernmental body, so all our decisions, including the formal approval of a report, has to be carried out by all the governments of the world in a plenary session. And the summary for policymakers, which is a very short summary of the entire report, each of the three working group reports and the so-called synthesis report, has to be approved line by line by all the governments of the world. And that, of course, is a very difficult task, but the benefit of going through that process is that at the end of the day, the report is owned by all the governments of the world. I'm mentioning this only because to say that we are not like a typical scientific body. You could get an excellent scientific report on science or space or climate change, but it will not carry the same weight that the IPCC report carries, simply because this is a scientific undertaking which is owned and approved by all the governments of the world. Now, as far as the main findings of the fourth assessment report are concerned, we have found a number of things. The first thing we have said is that change of the climate system is unequivocal. The fact that the climate of the earth is changing is something which is now beyond doubt. And this is not based on any theories, it is based on actual observations and measurements. And the changes that are taking place are of different kinds. Of course, we have a major increase in temperature, average temperatures, which during the 20th century amounted to about 0.74 degrees Celsius. And as a result of the warming, we also find that the level of the ocean has been going up. And in the 20th century, that was roughly 17 centimeters. This is happening for two reasons. Firstly, the oceans are expanding thermally because of higher temperatures. And it's also happening because the bodies of ice across the globe are melting very rapidly. The chairman mentioned to me earlier that he has been to the Arctic and to the North Pole.
In August.
And you just have to go there to see visually what is happening to the bodies of ice. He's also been to Greenland like I've been, and there are reasons for concern, because Greenland is a mountain of ice about 3 kilometers high. Similarly, if you go to West Antarctica, these are huge bodies of ice, and we have projected in the IPCC fourth assessment report that if any part of these two bodies of ice were to collapse and go into the ocean, then you would have sea level rise of 6 to 7 meters, several meters. And the last time this happened, 125,000 years ago, essentially when you had similar warming, that was for different reasons, we had sea levels of several meters higher than what we have today. But that, of course, is only in the realm of possibility. Nobody is making that projection or prediction. But what is happening is a number of changes in terms of the impacts of climate change are a cause for concern. Floods are increasing, droughts are increasing, heat waves are increasing, extreme precipitation events. I was in Mexico 4 days ago, and you must have read about the fact that there was a major mudslide over there. As a result of it, hundreds of people have died. A couple of days before that, I was in Guatemala, another country which is very vulnerable to disasters of various kinds. And now, with the impacts of climate change, those disasters will get much worse. And this is an important point that I think I should make. There are stresses, ecological stresses, all over the world. But with climate change, these will become much worse. And a simple example that I could give you is in 2008, there was a major cyclone in Myanmar, which is a country in the neighborhood of India, formerly known as Burma. And around 140,000 people died as a result of that cyclone called Cyclone Nargis. And one reason why that cyclone was much worse than would normally have been the case is because the sea level is much higher. So as a result, when you have that cyclone, there's a larger quantity of water on the continental shelf that gets picked up and carried by the cyclone onshore. Similarly, the tsunami that took place in 2004, it's not caused by climate change. It has nothing to do with climate change. But the impacts were much worse because the sea level is much higher today. If the sea level was not so high, then the same tsunami would probably have caused much less damage. We also know that the availability of water is going to get much worse. And in fact, the Mediterranean region in particular is very vulnerable to reduced availability of water. This is something that I'm sure you're aware of, you experience it every day, but the projections make it appear much worse in the future. So we have to be concerned about that. We also know that extreme precipitation events are on the increase. That means you will get large quantities of rainfall or snow in very short periods of time. And this is going to increase in frequency and intensity. And last but certainly not least, you have the problem of sea level rise, which for any coastal country is a source of concern. If you are living in a country like Bangladesh, which is low-lying, or the Maldives Islands, then clearly sea level rise is a matter of life and death. And therefore, you have to be concerned about it. Now, all of this, of course, is bad news. But what is the good news? The good news is that I think human society has the ability and certainly the responsibility to to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. We have already increased greenhouse gas concentration levels to a point where we have to start reducing it very rapidly. Because if we don't reduce that level rapidly, then clearly the impacts are going to get much worse over a period of time. As it happens, all the means by which we reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, that means higher energy efficiency, much greater use of renewable energy, perhaps changes in patterns of production and consumption, have enormous benefits. For instance, if we reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, we would also be reducing emissions of local pollutants. So that means we would get much better air quality at the local level, and therefore the health of human beings would improve as a result, because air quality is a source of serious health problems. We also know that there would be much greater energy security worldwide if we reduced emissions of greenhouse gases by reducing consumption of fossil fuels. Then clearly energy security in the world would improve substantially. Renewable sources of energy also generate greater employment. So it is entirely possible, even in periods of financial crisis, to shift the structure of the economy towards greater use of renewable energy. Of course, the capital investment required for renewable energy today is still very high, but over a period of time, there would be benefits in terms of greater employment and certainly in terms of reduced costs of supply of energy. So, as a result, some countries, certainly like South Korea, have adopted a green growth plan. And as a result, they've been able to get over their economic problems very rapidly in the last 2 years. In China, the recovery package that they have implemented is investing heavily in renewable sources of energy. Even in the US, President Obama has a large share of the recovery package going into renewable sources of energy and things like improve public transport, because as you know, North America has a terrible record of public transport, and that perhaps needs to be changed very rapidly. So the point I'd like to make is that while in these difficult economic times, to move away from business as usual is certainly very difficult, but the benefits over a period of time are so large, so substantial, that I think countries have to adopt a path by which we use renewable energy to a much greater extent. I had the pleasure of and the solemn experience of going to Fatima last evening. I've been there before, and I might tell you, I started my education in a convent and went through school in Christian schools in India. And
we are in a monastery.
That's right. And we studied the Bible in detail, both the Old and the New Testament. And I remembered from my childhood that I'd read this story of Fatima. And many years ago, I was here on a short UNDP assignment. And as we were driving along into the countryside, I saw signs to Fatima. So I asked my hosts, is this the same Fatima where three girls saw the Mother Mary? And they said, yes. I said, well, please change our plans, turn around, I'd like to go there. So I went there, and yesterday my colleague Meg Holden and I went again. It's a beautiful experience. And I just want to say that Portugal has unique opportunities. It is a country with enormous history, a great sense of global responsibility, and scientific and technical capabilities by which I think in Europe you can really lead the way. And it seems to me that we don't have too many choices, and we certainly don't have too much time. We have to move in a direction by which we use energy much more efficiently, and we use much larger quantities of renewable energy because you are blessed with so much of renewable energy. Yesterday I saw windmills on the way to Fatima. My colleague didn't see them because I think she was sleeping in the car. But you have enormous opportunities. I believe the wind speeds in Portugal are very favorable for the use of this technology. You also have plenty of sunshine and biomass. So I think Portugal has the opportunity to get into the lead as far as the post-oil energy possibilities are concerned. So thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'll be very happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Rajendra.
Thank you.
I was to mention that we are in a parliament, and in the parliament, MPs must talk.
Sure.
So they are going certainly to put some questions, and I'm very glad that you could answer to that.
Sure.
So I would like my colleagues, first Mr. António Leitão Amaro, this is an MP of our committee.
Yes.
You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. To our guests, it's a privilege for us to have you here and speaking to us. Thank you, Ms. Ambassador, for your presence. Your country is one that has strong connections to ours, so it's a privilege to have you here as well, knowing that this global perspective that Portugal always had in the world must be pursued with strong connections with a country like yours, for instance. I would like to ask you a couple of questions. The first one, you addressed briefly the issue of asymmetric impact of climate change. And you mentioned the case of the water availability. As far as your panel studied the micro impacts in different regions of the world, what is the specific or the biggest threats that the Mediterranean region and the Atlantic region, because we are in the, a point that both cross and have different microclimates and issues. So what should be the main threats that we should be concerned as being a Mediterranean and Atlantic country, and also an European country as well? So that is my first question. Second is, you focused mostly in the causes for climate change that arise from the greenhouse gases emissions. But is or are those emissions the only cause for climate change? I'm asking about the human causes. Of course, we all know the debate, is this climate change caused by human action, or is another one that was like those that have been caused before? But concerning human actions, it's just or mainly the greenhouse gases emissions or others that we should be concerned with. Another question is, you talked mostly about causes and actions that might be planned by countries individually. Our country is both connected and part of an European integration system, but also we have, as you probably know, a community with Portuguese-speaking countries. So what can be our role involving not only other European countries? I think we could be more happier. We could be happier with the leadership that Europe has been taking in the world concerning these issues. But what could also be our role involving other Portuguese-speaking countries? Third question, in terms of parliaments, what can be our role, like in mostly at national level? Do you feel that we have not only legislative mission, but also an educational mission. And can you talk to us about like good examples that you know of parliaments that have taken relevant actions in their countries to promote this fight that is very important? Finally, in terms of action that can be taken, you focused a lot in the energy production. Our country, we have been performing well in terms of increasing our renewable energy production, but we have been acting very poorly in terms of reducing our energy consumption in terms of energy efficiency. But it's more to talk than energy. There are other human patterns that cause great stress and climate stress. Can you talk us a little bit more on those issues? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Perhaps we could take two more questions. Sure. And our colleague, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you on behalf of the Democratic Christian Party, your presence here, Mr. Peshawar. I would like to thank Mrs. Ambassador attending this committee and taking the trouble to come here. Thank you very much. Mr. Peshawar, I would like to reflect with you about two or three different things and to separate the fields of global warming and human activity, if that is possible. That's good now. There is a part of international community scientific who says that the actual global warming on planet Earth is as it has been in the past, caused by the periodic increase of solar activity. And they say that the global warming caused by human activity is neglectable from that point of view, meaning that regardless of whatever efforts we make to reduce our activities that may contribute to that, in fact, we are going through a phase of planet Earth that is caused by the increase of solar activity, which happens with eruptions every 10,000 years, or there are periods of that, and that it is not the fact that we take preventive measures in our actions, industrial or others, that will stop this global warming. That is, I'm sure you are aware of this, and I would like your opinion about that. That's the first question. The second part, and that's why I ask if we could separate this, the second part is that regardless of what are the causes of global warming, we in fact as humans have the duty of care for the planet. We have to look after the planet and we have to conduct ourselves in a way that is sustainable and that does not cause harm to the planet and to the other species and tries to prevent as much as possible the lifestyle we have and the life in planet. And from that point of view, I would like also to know your opinion on the different activities and the different sources of alternative energies that we now have, which in your opinion would be the most environmentally sustainable from an environmental point of view, and namely, I would be very curious to know your opinion about nuclear energy and the new technologies on nuclear energy, because, as you know also, there is a very strong group around the world that defends that it is clean and that the new technology available makes it, I wouldn't say 100% safe, but 99% safe, and they say that there is no environmental impact. Third question, and finally, also based on scientific articles that I've read and the part of the scientific community that says that the ice cap meltdown in the North Pole and Greenland will in fact cause the interruption of the Mexican Gulf Stream, which will have as a side effect, as they say they had in the past, thousands of years ago, of creating the opposite effect of global warming, a new ice age. There is a scientific current that defends that, and I would like to know your opinion about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Perhaps another one, or sure. So now Mrs. Jamila Madeira.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. Pachauri, for being here, for giving us the honor of having this small conversation. It was to us very important to hear from you all the process of how do you get to your reports and how everyone is involved. But at this point, we can say the world is worried about economic and financial crisis, which may, or that's one of the points I would like to question you, may affect the goodwill on the climate change process or how the investment is made in climate change process. So, for instance, in Mediterranean, we had this big, we can say this prime and prioritary project, which was the pollution of the Mediterranean. It was set kind of 5 years ago, reset 3 years ago, and still not on the ground. So it means that after 2008, the target it's much more difficult to get. We had this process on the coastal regions in terms of European panorama. You had this good intervention that was set that all the coastal regions of Europe would work together to face climate change, to face recovery of their coastal zones, to face the impacts of climate change. But then nothing happened until now. We can say that in Portugal is one of the countries more affected for climate change, what means or give us the sense that it's a very slow process. In Portugal, we have been investing very much in changing to sustainable energies. This is very important, and to our government, it has been one of the, we can say, on our trademark. It's already a kind of Portugal going for a green country. We want to have that that mark in terms of energy, and we are working on that. We are putting a lot of investment on that. But obviously, we are facing now a very difficult financial period, and we don't know how it will go for the future. We don't know if we have the ability to continue, even if we have the political will to continue. This is very important because we know that this will give us some economical standard, but until we get there, it's a long way, and it demands a lot of investment in investigation and in the resources. So the thing is, this is not only happening in Portugal, it's happening all around the world. So how do you see, with all the conversations you had with worldwide governments, with all the perspectives you had in your reports, how do you see the ability of creating a worldwide fund that could be financed by everybody, but be an input in, the goal we want to achieve, how we work together in a worldwide project on stopping climate change? So this is my question.
And now Mr. Miguel Tiago, and now with this foreign group of questions, we covered all the parties represented in our committee. Miguel Tiago, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the Portuguese Communist Party, I would first of all like to thank you for this important opportunity for us to exchange some ideas about the problematic of climate change in the world and the views of the intergovernmental panel for climate change. Myself, I'm a scientist, so my perspective on this theme, it's what you may call it from the skeptic point of view about the climate change. So opposing to the most of my colleagues that face this problem as politicians merely, or probably like lawyers, or directly connected with their formation. I'm a geologist, so I tend to be, and I think it's my duty to be a little more skeptic about this. I would like, nevertheless, to leave some questions on the table. And, of course, I don't think it is the political job to question or to support any scientific theory. Science is the field, and political field should use what science gives you. So even though I'm a skeptic, of course, I should use the instruments that science gives me, and the IPCC is one of those science fields. So I would like to talk about the Jevons paradox, first of all, and to ask if there is any study from the part of the IPCC, or if Mr. Pashari has some understanding about this, about this main characteristic of the capitalist system, that is, when you increase the energy efficiency, you always increase the energy consumption. And since the Industrial Revolution, that is true for the capitalist system. Never happened the other way around. When you increase the energy efficiency, you increase the rate of consumption of energy, you accelerate the consumption of energy, regardless of of the source we're talking about, because the costs of production always decrease. So it's a stimulus to increasing production, overproduction, and the increase also of energy consumption. So this paradox, how can we overcome it? How can we somehow I believe there's no, when we search for profit, when the capitalist system searches for profit only as its main goal, it is not consentaneous with the decrease of energy consumption. Because the unit, the cost of the production unit is going down, is decreasing, so the energy consumption is always going up, is increasing. Also, I would like to ask you about your opinion on the carbon market in Europe. As you know, Europe is a pioneer, the European Union, in the carbon market, in the emission trading. And since 2005, there is a full working model of carbon trading in Europe. And nevertheless, the emissions still rise up. So what's your opinion on this solution for the control of greenhouse gases emissions? And another question, and there would be much more, but since our time is also reduced, I would state the last one. Renewable sources of energy, I have some doubts about the employment they create. I have read many studies that point otherwise, that with the increase of the cost of production, you may create some jobs directly in the sector of renewable energy, but you lose 20 times more in the industrial sector. I believe that can change. I believe even though it is a symptom of the actual state of evolution, I believe that can change. But what I would like to ask is the IPCC has already deepened studies or taken in account the exchanges between Earth, lithosphere and atmosphere, and the importance of that in hydrosphere, obviously, to the average temperature of the atmosphere in the case. The heat energy exchanges between the soil and the atmosphere, and the causes of intensive devastation of the vegetable, of the biosphere, and of the desertification of soils. I don't know if desertification is the right word. And also, the substitution of other sources of energy with dams for big dams, massive dams for the production of energy? And is that really a renewable energy, taking in account the effects that it takes in the climate locally, mainly locally, but also globally? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. As I said before, MPs naturally must talk, and so you have a lot of questions about this very important issue. Dr. Rajendra, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. if you'd permit me, I'll probably start with the last set of questions. And I can say one thing that I believe is essential to correct the situation that we have today is to see that we include in the price of energy the cost of the externalities that we are imposing. And that unfortunately doesn't happen. The price is set purely on the basis of financial values for energy are misleading. They are misleading for the simple reason that you mentioned, sir. If you look at hydro projects, we don't always look at all the ecological and environmental impacts of those hydro projects. If they were taken into account, then the price of supplying energy from a hydro project would be very different from what we have today. So this general principle, I think, applies even to the first question that you raised. For instance, in a capitalist system, if you increase energy efficiency, the impact is that the cost of using energy comes down, and therefore, yes, with the price being lowered, the demand goes up. And there again, I believe the reason why that happens is because we are not taking into account some of the environmental impacts, some of the other social impacts of energy use. And if all of this could be quantified and included in the price, then you would have a much fairer and a much more equitable market system. But this doesn't happen. You asked about the carbon market in Europe and the fact that emissions are going up. I believe that one reason why emissions are going up is because, really speaking, we don't have a global agreement to reduce emissions further. If, let's say, Europe was to follow up with the offer that you have of a 30% reduction by 2020, if other countries also provide somewhat more ambitious action, I think the price of energy in that case, with the price caps being much more stringent, would be much higher, and therefore you would have an impact on emissions. Emissions would start going down. So I think the main problem is that we don't have a global agreement. See, even in the Kyoto Protocol, you've got the Clean Development Mechanism, you've got emissions trading, you also have joint implementation. These are all measures, so-called financial measures that have been included in the Kyoto Protocol to allow trading of emissions reduction or emissions. The reason why that has not taken off adequately is because the US rejected the Kyoto Protocol, Australia rejected it, and therefore the size of the pie available for these transactions shrunk. It was much smaller. And therefore we have really not had enough trading in these areas. Now, I personally believe that quite apart from using the market, there is need perhaps to look at taxation by which energy can be taxed in a manner that at least internalizes some of the externalities that are being imposed on society, on the overall emissions and the impacts in terms of pollution and so on. In the case of renewables, of course we need much more evidence, but the initial evidence seems to suggest, and I've seen that from a number of countries and a number of case studies, that megawatt for megawatt, renewables generate much more employment. Now, I didn't quite understand how this might affect industrial activity. It could have a positive impact on industrial activity. I can give you an example. In India, we're trying very hard to implement two large solar thermal projects. Each one of these will be 3,000 megawatts plus. Now, the equipment required for this will all be fabricated in India. So quite apart from the benefits of using the sun, lowering the cost of energy over a period of time, you would also be generating a new industrial activity. And that will generate employment quite apart from the direct employment from this facility that's going to be set up. So I think the jury is still out. You have to carry out much more assessment of some of the projects that are coming up and are yet to come up to see whether you actually generate more employment. The indication is that you do, but you know that's something that we can look at and discuss. I respect the fact that you were very honest to say that you're a skeptic. You know, science would not thrive if there was no skepticism. Science requires questioning. And some of us do get upset when skeptics ask questions which don't make sense. But in the end, I think that's desirable. What is harmful is for some people who say they are skeptics but are actually acting on behalf of some lobby or the other. And you are aware of that. But if somebody has intellectual skepticism, I have a very healthy respect for that. And I think the scientific community must respect that. Because we can't expect everyone to accept whatever we say. That would be wrong. I mean, throughout history, when new knowledge has emerged, of course people have questioned it. But as a result, knowledge moves on. If you don't have skepticism, then there is no basis for questioning of whatever scientists say. So I respect that, sir. May I go to the next set of questions? Yes, we are going through an economic and financial crisis, but that is where I think you need an unprecedented vision to look beyond. Otherwise, you know, we may be compounding the problem. If we are going to look at old problems in terms of old solutions, I'm afraid we may get over the initial problems that we have today, the initial discomfort that we have with the financial system. But the problem may revisit us in a much more severe way sometime in the future. I mean, the basic reality is that the world is today importing, let's say, or using 80 million barrels plus of oil. And the bulk of it is coming from a limited part of the world. It's also true that in the last 20 years, there's been very little accretion to the reserves of oil. That's one part of the problem of energy security. The second part is that quite apart from the impacts of climate change and the fact that climate change is being caused at least in the last 5 decades or so by human action, solely by human action. It's also true that we have to find a means by which people in the world can get access to energy. And in a number of cases, that will only happen if we come up with simple solutions that harness renewable energy on a decentralized basis. There is a number anywhere from 1.4 to 1.6 billion people in this world who don't have access to electricity. And it is unlikely that with the conventional systems of supply, we'll be able to supply these people electricity in their homes. But remember, they don't have a single light bulb in their homes. So what do they use once the sun goes down? They use candles, they use kerosene lamps, they use other forms of combustion by which lighting is produced. And that's very harmful, because in a small little dwelling, You have a small lamp using kerosene that's emitting a whole lot of pollutants, which women and children in particular are taking into their lungs, and that's extremely harmful. So I believe that we need to move in a direction whereby we need to look beyond the current economic and financial crisis. As a matter of fact, the current financial crisis should jolt us into action to tell us about some of the fundamental problems we have. And unless we do that, we are not really creating a sustainable system. So some countries have been smart enough to realize this. Korea has a green growth plan. Germany has been emphasizing renewable energy and energy efficiency. Of course, it's another matter that they will not impose speed limits on their autobahns, but that's part of German culture. I mean, that's the one country where you're driving at 125 kilometers per hour and suddenly you find a car zoom past you like that and you wonder whether that's a car or an airplane. But I mean, that's another matter. The fact is that they have done very well and they've generated jobs. They have certainly been able to recover financially, despite the fact that they are moving away from fossil fuels in a big way. You mentioned the Mediterranean Pollution Project. Yes, I'm afraid there is a lot of inertia in decision making. And I think this is where the question was asked, and I was going to answer that later, whether parliaments, whether governments have a responsibility to inform the public. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that for democracies to function efficiently, we have to inform the public. And we're not doing enough of that. And today, with the communication systems we have, it is entirely possible to use existing channels for spreading knowledge, for spreading information, and most importantly, for educating youth. Because that's where the hope lies. If we can educate the youth of today, then I think we have reason to be optimistic about change and improvements in the future. Investments in green energy, I think it is inevitable. And you raised the question, ma'am, whether we should have some kind of a worldwide fund. It would be wonderful if we could do that. Unfortunately, at the moment, you find some of the most prosperous nations showing complete unwillingness to fund anything to do with climate change. But one innovative method by which we could do that would be to see that at least we subsidize interest. We don't necessarily provide grant money for some of these activities, but on a recurring basis, subsidize the interest. Because if you can do that, I mean, I was mentioning the example of the 3,000 megawatt plants that we are trying to set up in India for solar thermal power generation. We find that if the cost of financing is about 7% per annum, it is almost competitive with coal-based power. But the moment the cost of interest goes up to 10, 12, 15%, then it becomes very, very difficult. So I think we need to be clever, and we need to find ways by which the global community can bring about this shift. And it's not difficult, because if you look at what the whole world has spent on the so-called recovery package, my own back-of-the-envelope calculation is that we have spent something like $3 trillion. I mean, $3 trillion to meet the financial crisis in the short term, in my view, would be a big mistake, unless a significant fraction of that goes into meeting the longer-term challenge. I think we need a debate. I think parliaments like this must debate these issues. And I think you need to debate this with other countries in Europe and across the Atlantic with your counterparts in North America, because we have to bring about a shift in thinking over here. Unless we do that, we are going to continue with business as usual, and we may postpone the problem from today to maybe 10 years later. but it will come back. It's just a matter of time. So this is what I would say on the second set of questions. The third set of questions. The second set of questions. I think the point that was raised about whether climate change is being caused by human activity or not, I would like to submit that if you look at our fourth assessment report, we have, I wish I had it with me today, we have now got models that are perfectly reliable in separating the human influence from the natural influence. So if you run a set of these models, and in fact there's a diagram over there, you've got observations of increase in temperature going up like this, and then you run the model with all the solar activity on which we have data, then you get a warming which comes something like this. But the moment you add human influence, that means the increase in the concentration of gases in the atmosphere, you get almost a perfect fit with the actual observations. So in other words, today I think knowledge has advanced to a level where we can sit down with those who say, oh, this is because of solar activity, to show them exactly how much has been caused by solar activity and how much has been caused by human influence. And our finding is very clear, with a 90% probability, that in the last 5 decades, whatever change in climate has taken place is largely the result of human actions. There is enough scientific basis to be able to make that assertion. Yes, tomorrow we could get solar activity which we can't predict, that could even cause cooling. Who knows? It has just happened in the past, and it could happen again. But we need to do what we are responsible for. Human society cannot play God, but human society should at least be responsible to our own fellow humans. And therefore, I think we need to do something. Yes, the point you made, sir, about the fact that, yes, it is a duty that we have to perform. And the reasons why I said that doing all this is so attractive is because there are so many co-benefits. I mean, today we have an energy system which causes enormous sense of insecurity. I mean, suppose oil prices go up to $150 a barrel tomorrow. Of course, right now there is a glut in the market, I understand. But who knows, 5 years from now, with the growth in demand in China, in India, and in other parts of the world, we would run into a serious crisis. And unfortunately, I mean, I can say this about my own country, we are foolishly following the developed countries. We are producing more and more cars. We are not investing in public transport. Our buildings are inefficient. We use energy very inefficiently in every sector of the economy. Now, in all of this, you actually save money. I mean, if you had better public transport, you would have a much cheaper transport system, and it would be accessible to the poorest of the poor. What we are creating is a system which is meant only for the elite. How many people can afford a taxi? In a poor country like mine, I mean, the only thing that people can afford is a bus or a train, or they walk. So I think what we are creating is a system that foolishly is emulating the countries which have really set a standard that is not sustainable. There's a very distinguished scientist, Paul Ehrlich, who talks about developing countries, developed countries, and maldeveloped countries. There are a number of countries which are maldeveloped, and they have to now redevelop. They must move in a direction by which they change what they regard as sacred. And that, unfortunately, causes a lot of problems because there are very strong lobbies. So you're from the Communist Party, you would realize that in the capitalist system today, the power of advertising, the power of lobbyists, really distorts even parliamentary action. And I'm not talking of this country, but you know the countries that I'm referring to. And that is dangerous. that clearly distorts democracy. I mean, decisions are being taken by vested interests, by powerful lobbies. How can we ensure that the human race is going to have its interests served if the highest forms of government, that's the Senate, the Congress, the Parliament, is influenced by narrow and selfish short-term interest? I think that has to change. And I'm glad that, you know, in this Parliament you have different shades of opinion, and therefore there is a balance. I think we have that to some extent in India also. This is something that I wanted to emphasize. The question was asked about renewable energy. I think you need a mix of renewable sources of energy, including means by which we improve energy efficiency. Nuclear, 20 years ago, I was a great skeptic about nuclear. But I have now seen the developments that are taking place and the options that are available. I think you can't dismiss nuclear. It is a serious option. And I think we need to look at it very carefully, because it has now become inherently safer. Of course, there are problems of storage of waste, which we have not solved. And that remains a serious problem. But on the other hand, in several other respects, nuclear has become a much more serious option than it was earlier. ice melting, yes, it's entirely possible that with natural factors we could see a new ice age coming in. Those of you who've seen the movie The Day After Tomorrow would remember what happens to the city of New York. And that can happen if the Gulf Stream were to break down. Now, we have clearly brought out that the Gulf Stream is weakening. Of course, we've also said that there's very little possibility of it breaking down, at least in the 21st century. But human beings have a talent for defying predictions of this nature, because when it comes to creating disasters, we can be rather irresponsible and excellent in creating disasters. So, in my view, if we continue on the path, then the level of risk that we have today can change. It can increase enormously. Let me go to the first set of questions. The impacts of Portugal are going to be varied. You asked specifically about water. Well, our projections indicate that the entire Mediterranean region will have problems of water supply. And rainfall levels are likely to go down over a period of time. So water, given the fact that, you know, economic growth is going to demand more and more water, would be a serious resource for you. The Gulf Stream, as I mentioned, is weakening, and it may not lead to any dramatic change in climate as a result, but you could certainly start seeing some influence in terms of much colder winters, for instance. But we also have clearly assessed that the impact of warming is most likely going to be higher than anything that comes by way of weakening of the Gulf Stream. So the net effect is likely to be one of warming. And therefore, I wouldn't worry about much colder temperatures in Portugal. Greenhouse gas emissions, the sources are very well known and very well documented. Yes, in order to mitigate these emissions, we don't only need to deal with the energy supply industry. I mentioned the case of transport. We need a restructuring of the transport sector. Agriculture can be a great source of emissions. In many parts of the world, deforestation is a very serious problem. My hope is that in Cancun, at least we get some projects off the ground as far as RED is concerned, reducing deforestation and degradation, afforestation, expansion of forestry area, because cutting down of forests is a major source of emissions, and that's something which can be fixed relatively easily. You asked about what you could do with Portuguese-speaking countries. Well, you've got a major power, emerging power like Brazil. You can work with them to sort of provide South-South cooperation. I think that has a lot of benefit. I also believe it would be very helpful for Portugal to work with intellectual help to countries like Mozambique, where the impacts of climate change are going to be very serious. They have to start adapting to those impacts. So maybe Portugal can help in that regard. So I think there's a range of things that you could do in partnership with some of these countries, and bringing in partners from outside the Portuguese-speaking region as well. You asked about the role of Parliament. I think Parliament, in my view, needs to do two things. To look beyond the immediate. And parliaments don't always do that, because after all, we know that in a democracy, the term of office is very short. You have to make sure that your constituents are not upset with you. You've got to do things that suit them in the short term. But there are also examples of parliaments that have been able to bring about a vision in their decision making, in their legislation. And I think particularly for industry, it's very important to get a very clear roadmap. If, let us say, you were to lay down some targets for 2030 in terms of use of renewable energy, you could say that there will be taxation, progressive taxation or progressive regulation by which renewable energy will be encouraged. Then I think industry will respond. They would know where their future lies, and they will work in that direction. So, and of course, bringing about education is most important. In India, the Supreme Court came up with a ruling that environmental education is essential in the schools. And that has made an enormous difference. Today I talk to school children, and it's fascinating. It's so encouraging to find out how concerned they are about the environment. I think a simple thing like environmental education at the school level can make an enormous difference. If Parliament was to legislate that this should be an important subject, I think it will make a lot of difference. The last point I would make is about energy production, efficiency improvements. Well, we also have to bring about lifestyle changes. I mean, people don't want to hear about this, but the time has come when we have to look at lifestyle changes very seriously. I mean, the whole principle of reduce, reuse, recycle is going to be very important. I get very upset when I find people wasting food, for instance. You fill up your plate, and there are times when I do it also, I feel bad about it. You fill up your plate and you throw it away. Half of it is eaten, half is not eaten. People go to shopping malls just to see how that glitter will tempt them to buy something or the other. I never do that. I find it completely offensive to walk around a shopping mall looking for something to buy just because I want to spend my money. I buy things that I need. And I think some change in ethics is required. I'm not saying that we all have to go and live in caves and clothe ourselves in sheepskin. It might be fashionable to do that, but I think we need lifestyle changes, and we have to start thinking about it seriously. So this is what I would say in response, Mr. Chairman. And
thank you very much. I know that your agenda is very intense, but I would like at this moment to be grateful to your presence here and to answer naturally to the questions that our colleagues and my colleagues put about these issues. And as you understood, our committee is worried about these matters, these issues, and naturally we are working on that. And the sensibilization about that is very important. So it was very important your coming to our committee, that opportunity, and of course I must be grateful also about the words you said about Portugal. We have the same opinion about India, that is a great country. And we have some links about India, as you remember.
about some areas where Portuguese is speaking also. And so thank you again for your presence. Thank you for your words about my country. Thank you naturally to the ambassador that is with Dr. Rajendra and the assistant. And in the name of my committee, I would like to give you a souvenir, a remembrance of our parliament to testify the presence in the Portuguese parliament. That is a monastery, was a former monastery.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And to the assistant. And some books about the publications, about initiatives of our committee.
Thank you very much.
So thank you again, and the ambassador also, and your equipe, and naturally thank you to my colleagues that were here in this meeting. So
thank you very much, sir. Thank you. And thank you for these gifts, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, distinguished members of Parliament. I just want to say that I believe we have a lot in common. You know, both our societies consist of people who talk a lot. In fact, our famous economist, Professor Amartya Sen, has written a book called The Argumentative Indian. And in that, we enjoy the same capabilities that you have in Portugal. And of course, we've had a long history. A month ago, I went to a church in South India, which is very famous, in a place called Vilenkani. This was established by a group of sailors, Portuguese sailors, a few hundred years ago. They were about to sink. Their ship was in trouble, and they prayed to the Mother Mary, who performed a miracle, and their lives were saved. So they built this church in her honor, and I went there. And it's a church where every religion feels comfortable going. So I was very touched that, you know, we've had this kind of relationship over a period of time. And I hope I will have the privilege of coming back here, Mr. Chairman. And I hope some of you will travel to India. I'm very grateful that Her Excellency the Ambassador took the time off to come here. And I hope we can build a closer and a stronger relationship between our two societies. Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Thank you.